James, I believe your hand is up.
Well, I want to add, one of the things that I'm interested in is I know that you've done, you're among the things I think you're best known for is your work interviewing Noam Chomsky periodically and then publishing those texts. And so I presume you've had a chance perhaps to be interviewing Noam while you're here in town. So I would wonder if you'd give us a little bit of an update on where your conversations with Noam are going recently, and a little segue, if you will, to something I just found over posted on the community bulletin board here, which I think you'll have interesting comments about. It purports to be an analysis of how the Gatekeeper Foundations are funding phony left media. And you can even find Noam here as perhaps among the phony left. So if maybe you could also sort of comment on that strange...
Yeah, I haven't seen this, so it does look rather strange. Z Magazine is part of this, Counterspin, Fair, but not... I don't see alternative radio on it. I've done a good job of camouflage. Pacifica, Democracy Now!, Deep Dish TV. Amy Goodman has her own line. The Nation, Global Exchange, which Medea Benjamin founded. Working Assets. I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, again, Arundhati Roy has written about this and talked about what she calls the NGOization of dissent, particularly in India, where a lot of the so-called grassroots organizations are in fact funded by corporations who want to direct dissent in a certain way and to control it by funding these groups. So I think, you know, one has to be realistic and, you know, keep your eyes open at all times, you know. But we do know that ALEC, which is largely funded by the Koch brothers and other organizations, are creating, you know, are conducting greenwashing campaigns, campaigns that, you know, purport to show that fracking does not damage the environment, that, you know, carbon emissions are not what they're cranked up to be, and there's no such thing as global warming. You know, there's all of this astroturfing going on, and they come out, I mean, when... I forget who told me this, but whenever you see the word freedom, liberty, or democracy in some group's title, just back off for a second, because it's usually a sign that they're against those things. But they use the good name to kind of hoodwink people, just as a word of caution. So, I mean, what did I talk with? I spent 3 hours with Chomsky on Monday. And of course, for reasons of national security, I can't reveal what I said or what he said. But, you know, we talked about current events and actually delving into early childhood memories and how they impact him today, what kind of influence they have in terms of his thinking. And actually, you know, those interviews are so incredibly intense. For me, I'm exhausted when I finish them, particularly one as long as 3 hours. And I don't remember a lot of what transpired. So when I get the text, or when I hear the audio, it'll all come back. But right now, I really couldn't give you a straight answer, you know, on a lot of things because of the intellectual intensity of it. And being in the moment and having to pay attention. It's not easy to interview, by the way. Very difficult, unlike Howard Zinn, for example. Well, he's very discursive. So because he knows so much, you ask a direct question, and then all of a sudden, I asked him about anarchism, and then he started talking about the Spanish Civil War, and that immediately segued into Haiti. And Texaco exporting oil to Haiti during the military junta, which replicated you know, what was happening during the fight against Franco and the fascists in Spain. So that went on for quite a long period of time because he has such a wealth of knowledge, has so much information that sometimes he can't even control it. You know, and you can't say you've got 30 seconds or you've got 15 seconds. I asked, okay, now here's a good point I think you might find interesting. I asked him a couple of specific yes or no questions. Just, I want you to answer. You know, like, do you believe the sun rises in the east? Yes or no? No. There was. He didn't say no to that. I didn't ask. That wasn't the question. But he has to give the context. He has to give the background so that you won't find him saying, you know, yes or no. And he doesn't like to rob people of coming to judgments on their own. I think that's the anarchist kind of libertarian, not these libertarians, these crazies, but the real libertarians, not to rob your autonomy by saying, okay, he said the sun rises in the east, I'll say the same thing. You know, he wants you to come through deduction, through study, through discussion, to come to your own judgment. And I think that's very liberating and very honoring of your individuality. Whereas you have, you know, I'm this smart professor, world famous, you do, you know, this is what I think, you should think the way I think.
It can also be frustrating because I think a lot of people are looking for guidance.
He is offering a wealth of analysis that is simply unmatched anywhere. And that's his, I think, his role in society, is to be that information person. This is, you know, this is how I see things. Other people can do the leadership part, but that's not who he is. And those kinds of expectations, I think, are not well placed because he's incapable of that and wouldn't even do it if he could. You know, I once asked him, like in another conversation, you know, I said, you're a pretty boring speaker. It's true. I mean, it's a monotone. I mean, he wouldn't do any of this stuff, like this kind of song and dance that I did for you this evening. Nothing like that. Well, whatever. I mean, he's a very serious scholar, you know, he presents this. And he once told me that even if he had charisma, he would never use it. Because it's a form of manipulation. And you see that with people who have charisma. People suspend their judgment, stop thinking, because the leader has been found, the halo has been established around the leader's head, and everyone is marching in lockstep. That is antithetical to the anarchist philosophy.
Okay. I'm wondering if going around the country, if you're seeing an alternative source for journalism given the death of American newspapers. Because people are saying, oh, that's just being replaced by the internet. It's just that we're not killing trees. But a lot of people are saying, well, right, we have the alternative way to distribute news on the internet instead of a newspaper, but the source for journalists who get paid jobs are going away. With the death of the newspapers, those people are all winding up with catering jobs, so they're no longer doing journalism. So I'm just wondering, looking around the country, do you see a source for growing journalism in the face of the death of the newspapers around the country?
Yes. Al Jazeera America, for example, has now opened bureaus in cities in the United States that are great, you know, American newspaper giants have abandoned. Philadelphia, Baltimore, Detroit, New Orleans, and other cities now have bureaus because of Jazeera. But that's just one example. I mean, that's not going to address the whole crisis in print journalism. And as you correctly say, lots of people have lost their jobs, or they're writing for the internet or on online publications, but they can't make any money. And there's no money for investigative journalism. So this is a real problem. And one of the reasons I find that this new venture so exciting is that it is injecting some cash into old-fashioned, get dirt under your fingernails journalism. That's this Pierre Omidyar. So also there's a, again, because you have such a pathetic radio situation here in Boston, around the country, there is a very vibrant community radio network where a lot of people get their information from local sources, local news people like KGNU in Boulder, my home station. There's WMNF in Tampa. There's WORT in Madison. There are all kinds of stations around the country that are providing a lot of local news. They're not really equipped to do certainly international, very little, and some national. So that's a positive thing. A lot of the magazines have shrunk or disappeared, hard editions. What is going to happen to journalism is a huge question that Bob McChesney has been examining more than anyone. He and John Nichols have been tackling this, and what they propose I don't think is politically viable, and that is to say that there would be subsidies through the post office to support independent investigative journalism. In this climate, I think that's kind of wishful thinking. I hope I'm wrong, but I don't see public support for that kind of thing. You know, one of the one of the infamous things that the right wing, you know, and the Koch brothers and these other, you know, the Heritage Foundation and American Enterprise Institute and all the other right wing think tanks, they're called, and foundations, has really been to sour people on government, to sour people on the notion of collective action having any value, having any intrinsic value. You know, so they're just, you know, pointy-headed bureaucrats. It starts with Reagan, but it goes back in American history. I mean, there's a whole anti-state kind of vibe that has been in the country for a long time, but it really picked up with Reagan. And that's where, you know, the shrinking of government starts, and that's where wages, incidentally, go flat. That's where people start going into debt because credit cards become easily available. That's when outsourcing begins. I mean, there was a whole cascade of things happening right at the same time. I mean, from 1945 to about 1980, the United States had the greatest economic expansion in the history of the world. That was unprecedented. That's the second time I've used it. Extraordinary. And then things started to change. So actual wages that workers are earning today are less than what they were 30 years ago.
I think it started a little earlier.
75. But with Reagan, there's an icon articulating the pointy-headed bureaucrats that the problem is big government, you know, not big corporations. Yes, but the nanny state in this sense is the subsidies given to large corporations. Yeah. Everybody else is supposed to bite the bullet of austerity, but corporations are supposed to be lavished with our tax money because we're so generous and kind.
David, I want to take issue with the comment you made about radio here in Boston, but
okay.
Not right now.
WMBR.
I'm going to let Linda, who's gracious enough to host this event.
Well, not just me, it's the community church, but thank you. So I wanted to ask about where you may see some growing edges of this structural change that needs to happen and make a suggestion, if I may, about where I see a bit of an edge. And where I see it locally is with the Boston school bus drivers that have taken on Veolia, which is a French-based mega corporation that has its tentacles into many municipal services in cities in the United States and also around the world. They provide the segregated municipal transportation in Israel, Palestine. And they're also into water privatization and waste disposal. I just saw a Veolia van in East Cambridge that said biohazard waste management, and it just gave me the heebie-jeebies. But the bus drivers union, which is about 800 Haitian and Haitian Americans primarily, have taken on this corporation, which has been brought in really by Menino to bust this union. And they're not, you know, they're building a coalition now within Boston. I mean, Vets for Peace have been there, and the ACLU, and a number of sort of varied groups on the left that are supporting them in this fight. And they're also beginning to reach around the world to get informed about how this corporation has its tentacles all over the place. But it's been below the radar. The corporate media put out a bunch of disinformation and continues to misinform. So that's something that's going on here.
That's great to hear.
But I think it would be good to hear from you where you think the growing edges are or the emerging sprouts of this kind of structural change may be.
Well, I think, you know, one of the side effects of the great crash of 07-08 is a realization that a class war is being waged in the United States. And no less an authority than Warren Buffett attests to that. He said, there is a class war, and my class is winning. And I think a lot of people have lost their jobs, have lost their, you know, their savings, their pensions, don't have, you know, health care, etc., have endured an enormous amount of suffering. And I think there has been an awareness, particularly because of the Occupy movement, that there is a war being waged against the middle class, against poor people in particular, who are routinely vilified for, you know, lacking in the proper tools to become productive members of society, as they like to say. So I think that awareness, if it's transferred, if it morphs into cynicism, it's useless. It's paralytic. Cynicism will arrest any kind of hope for development and positive change. We need to be positive and optimistic and not succumb to cynicism. And I'm sure you know people, maybe even yourself or myself, saying, you know, it doesn't matter, the game's over, they're going to do what they want to do, what difference does it make, I'm only one person. Yes, you are only one person, but one person who meets, like in that Marge Piercy poem, who connects with other persons, can build a movement, can change things. I think the most encouraging thing is the huge growth in co-ops, worker co-ops, as a way to democratize the economic system and to share the wealth in a more equitable way. That is, it's really under the radar. There are tens of thousands of these enterprises that have sprung up, you know, all over the country. Now, it hasn't hit critical mass. I mean, but I didn't know that Ace Hardware was one of these co-ops, or that, insurance company? Nationwide. Land O'Lakes Butter. You know, and a Union Taxi in Madison. There's so many. That, I think, is one way where we can develop a more democratic workspace. You know, and I think maybe part of that, I don't think maybe, I think reviving unions, reviving collective action is so important, because unions have always been, you know, in the phalanx of social change. And a lot of the, you know, benefits that we are enjoying today, quote unquote, like the weekend, like paid vacations. Does anyone have paid vacations anymore? Or had? Those kinds of things came because of union struggles. So I think supporting unionization is also important. But the co-ops seems to be, right now, the brightest hope out there.
Okay. So I just want to recommend a book to anybody who hasn't read it. There's a book by the same title, actually, Reform or Revolution, by the great German revolutionary Rosa Luxemburg, which was brilliant. I think it covers a lot. It actually talks about the same topics, even though it's about 100 years written 100 years ago. There was something I want to bring up, an event that happened recently in Seattle, and I think this is actually of a huge importance. I'm a member of an organization called Socialist Alternative. We're a revolutionary socialist organization, and we ran candidates in this corporate system, which you discussed a little bit at the beginning about how heavily the system is geared towards corporate candidates. Well, we ran against it, and we won. We won a socialist.
Kashama.
Yeah, Shama Sawant.
Kashama, yeah, Sawant. Yeah. Yeah,
she
great.
Ran and won. And a few things about this campaign. We took no corporate money, none. That was just off the table completely. We organized among working class people and appealed to them to help support our campaign. And the working class, being as numerous as it is, a little bit of money from a lot of people can go a long way. And it was actually successful in this case. And with that, we're actually using it as a basis. You talked about leadership. I think Shamra's shown that to a certain extent, that leadership means being able to follow as well. And she's following the lead of the fast food workers going up for $15 an hour. She said, well, you're calling for $15 an hour. Every worker should get $15 an hour, so we're going to call that for the minimum wage. So I was just raising what this is sort of a Chomsky intro to a question. What is your opinion of this sort of electoral action? As far as politics goes, we have sort of cracked open the shell of corporate politics, and we are an independent voice, socialist political voice. And I do think that there are other left-wing organizations who are sort of learning from this and going to emulate it in the coming future. We're going to see more openings politically, and it's very popular. You look at polls. People don't support the Democrats or Republicans, but they just don't have any other choice. Well, here we are. You know, we left-wing activists can offer that choice, but we have to be political, but we have to be principled as well and keep our hands clean from the corporate money. And organize where our strength is, the base, which is the enormous sleeping giant of the American working class. So I just want your opinion on that, and see if there's any. If you agree with me that there are prospects in the future for this kind of action.
No, an excellent point, and I was very heartened by Kashama Sawant's victory in the Seattle City Council. Also, in that same election, workers in SeaTac passed a resolution insisting on $15 an hour. So that's, you know, really positive. I think where the inroads can be made right now are exactly on this level, at school boards and city councils, not for governor, not for senator, not certainly not for president. I think, you know, and the right wing has been very successful in hijacking school boards, reorienting texts and curricula to their favor. Because nobody votes in these elections, nobody cares about them. You do.
People don't get involved. Right?
People don't get involved. It's not cool. It's not sexy. But I think the openings are there, and so we've got to seize these opportunities as they come up. You know, is it going to be the final answer? Maybe not. But to start getting candidates in, even if when they don't win. If the ideas get circulated, I mean, like, take Upton Sinclair, for example, an avowed socialist. He ran an openly socialist campaign for governor of California in 1931. And the corporations in Hollywood went berserk, and they threw so much money at him that he lost the election. I mean, he was a hugely popular novelist, you know. Oil, The Brass Check, The Jungle, these are all, like, must-reads. For that generation, or those, you know, in those years, but Sinclair in his campaign talked about Social Security. He talked about unemployment insurance. Talked about civilian conservation corps and things like that. Oh, guess who was listening? Franklin D. Roosevelt, who was elected the next year and had this huge crisis of capitalism, and he adopted a lot of the ideas that Sinclair himself had taken from previous activists like Eugene Victor Debs and others. So you see how this, it gets into circulation. And once it gets, and that's how, you know, we can push the envelope by, you know, getting those ideas out there. And using the word socialist, not as a expletive, as it has been used in the corporate media, but as a very noble political alternative that requires collective action. And by the way, no matter what you may think about the environmental crisis, there is no way it is going to be addressed successfully by one-off countries doing something. So you've all heard about Bhutan and, you know, the enlightened leader there who's, you know, passing all kinds of legislation about the environment. Well, that's not going to do it. In fact, Bhutan and 97 other countries together are not going to do it. It has to be everyone. It has to be a global effort. That's the only way the environment is going to be preserved, and that is collective. You know, okay, don't use, you know, is socialist too hot of a word for some people? I don't know. It's not. I don't think it should be. It's a very honorable term, and, you know, it wasn't by accident that Lenin took socialism into the title of the Soviet Union, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, at a time when socialism had enormous global popularity and enormous global prestige. And he wanted to graft onto that prestige by putting it into the Soviet Union. Of course, the Soviet Union, as it developed in a Leninist, Stalinist manner, had nothing to do with socialism, which is ultimately, at its core, democratic. Okay, we're just one more. I got a very early morning flight tomorrow.
My name is Bob. I'm here from representing Veterans for Peace.
Hi, Bob.
We have several people here that know what's going on. One of the things I wanted to bring up is we do have an alternative radio station. Unfortunately, it's not over the airwaves. It is OBR.FM. And I am the host and producer of Veterans for Peace Radio, which airs every Monday live from 6 to 7 on its streams over OBR.FM. Except for the second Monday, which will be a pre-record, because that second Monday is when we have our monthly meeting. So we talk
it's
about...
W-O-B-R?
No. Occupy Boston Radio.
OBRFM.
No, it's not on the air. It's only on the web.
On the web.
On the web, if you just put in OBR.FM, it will take you directly to the station.
And thank you. I'd love to share some of my material with you.
What I would like to say is that we don't just talk about veterans' issues, because we realize that a lot of our issues are very complex and interconnected in various ways. The people, now our ratings go up and down and up and down, but I can actually tell how many people are listening because it pops right up. And sometimes we have quite a few, but we do maintain, and we are going to expand. So I'm going to go from one-hour show a week to probably three two-hour shows per week, because there are so many issues that need to be dealt with, you know, so...
Thank you for doing that. All right, thank you all so very much for coming.
You've been listening to author, media critic, and radio producer David Barsamian speaking at the Community Church of Boston on Friday, February 7th, 2014. Recorded and edited by your announcer, Chuck Rosina. For more information about David's weekly programs and podcasts, go to alternativeradio.org. For the Boston Community Reporters Project, I am Chuck Rosina. Thanks for listening.